This podcast of Word of Mouth is supported in part by Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine, information at doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From the Battle of Gettysburg to September 11th, the assassinations of Abraham Lincoln and John Kennedy, the moon landing, and the 30th anniversary of Star Wars, U.S. postage stamps have commemorated some of America's key historical and cultural moments. Beyond memorializing shared milestones, stamps tell a deeper story of American history and preferences and creativity and self-image. Chris West explores all of those layers of narrative in his book, A History of America in 36 Postage Stamps. Chris West, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia.
The very first stamp in America was the result of the Stamp Act in 1765, which actually resulted in the Boston Tea Party. So America really started with a hatred of stamps. What was going on?
Well, it wasn't really a postage stamp. It was a revenue stamp. But if you're doing a history of America, you've really got to start around about the War of Independence. It was the first real example of taxation without representation. It meant that any printed paper had to have a stamp embossed on it, for which you had to pay the taxman for the privilege. So it's a bit like, I don't know, having a tax on emails or a tax on telephone conversations or something. It was a tax on communication, and it really bit into people's lives in the way that taxation hadn't before. So it was very unpopular. And as things were in those days, politics was carried on in the streets, and effigies of the stamp commissioners were burnt in the streets. And there was a slogan, liberty, property, and no stamps.
When did the U.S. actually start using stamps for postage?
The first formal U.S. government stamps came out in 1847, when there was a 5 cent with Ben Franklin and a 10 cents with George Washington on. So that's really when it sort of officially began.
I have to stop you. 5 and 10 cents? That was a lot of money back then.
Yeah, it was. Yes, I mean, you know, it was an expensive business getting post around the place in those days. We didn't, you know, there was a rider had to carry stuff through pretty rough country to get it from A to B. So it was an expensive business getting mail around.
How had letters been sent prior to these postage stamps in 1847?
Well, there had always been systems. Way back in 1639, there was a system whereby letters would arrive in Boston and they'd be taken to the house of a guy called Richard Fairbanks, and you could just come and pick the letters up. You had to pay for the privilege. Then there were various attempts made at a kind of postal distribution system, most of which didn't work until 1711. And finally, a system got off the ground. And, of course, 20 years after that, Ben Franklin was postmaster of Philadelphia. And it sort of grew from there, really.
So Ben Franklin's image was on some of those first stamps. Also, George Washington, with the Roman numeral X. Now, what was going on there? What were they trying to communicate?
That's a very interesting question. And the answer is nobody knows. I was speaking to a collection of real expert philatelists last night in New York, and I asked this question and nobody knew the answer. But of course, it does say a lot about George Washington. It shows that he was a man of sort of classical education. He'd read Roman and Greek writers. He was connected with the British sort of establishment in that way, in a way that Franklin wasn't. Franklin's very much a sort of self-taught guy.
And you talk about Franklin, the 1 cent Benjamin Franklin stamp. Now, this was began in
That came out in 1851.
Now, this stamp had entire books written about it. Why is it so beloved?
Well, there are so many varieties of it. Philatelists love variety. You know, if there's an extra dot in the left-hand corner, everyone goes nuts about it. So it's they love it. So, and because the technology was new, the printing, no two Ben Franklin 1851s are quite the same.
All of the stamps that we talked about, you know, these feature national leaders. When did the U.S. Postal Service depart from that tradition?
Well, they departed in 1869 when they came out with what I consider to be, and many other stamp collectors now, consider to be a beautiful series. My favourite is a picture of a wonderful Baldwin 24-ton locomotive on it, with a great, you know, great big cow catcher and that great big smokestack, and you can just imagine it going across the Wild West. In 1869, nobody liked it. They hated it. Where's George Washington? They said, we don't want a locomotive on our stamps. We want George Washington. So the issue was removed, and they went back to showing national leaders.
But the reaction to the locomotive does raise a question. Were stamps more cherished back then? I mean, have they lost that kind of significance, the ability to rile the public through the years?
I don't think so, no. I think that people do take them seriously. I think, obviously, now... Well, the Potter one's a very interesting example of that, because there was quite a fuss about that, because they showed living people, and there's been a kind of unwritten rule that you don't show living people on US stamps. Mm-hmm. So the president doesn't get shown until he's passed away. And then there's Daniel Radcliffe on the stamp waving his wand around, and there's a living person. And the USPS say, well, it's not really a living person. It's a role played in a film. And that was quite controversial. A lot of people said, hey, this is breaking a long tradition. We don't like this.
Let's go back then to some of the earlier stamps. America started to use stamps in 1847. Now, 14 years later, it enters the Civil War. What kinds of changes do we see in stamps during that time?
Well, obviously the main one is you get two loads of stamps. You get the Union stamps, and the Confederates issued their own stamps. And they actually broke the rule. And they had a stamp with Jefferson Davis on it, mm-hmm. who was the president of the Confederate States of America. So you could argue, well, it wasn't a US stamp, so the rule is the same. But a stamp from what is now the USA, he was for many years the only living person to have been shown on a stamp.
You know what I think about, like, during that time, how important was postage to the country during that time?
It was incredibly important. I mean, you see it in these heartbreaking letters that people have from the front. No other war had had that before. The Civil War was kind of the first postal war, really.
But, of course, President Lincoln was also assassinated.
Yes, indeed.
Well, how soon was he memorialized by the Postal Service?
Well, he was memorialized a year after. There was a year of mourning, and then on April the 14th, 1866, a rather sombre black 15-cent stamp came out. He's looking rather haunted on it. It is a stamp of deep tragedy, I think, because that was such a tragedy for the nation.
We're speaking with Chris West. He's author of A History of America in 36 Postage Stamps. It's a glimpse of America's rich philatelic history, from George Washington's grave gaze to the charging buffalo of the Western frontier, Lindbergh's soaring biplane, and, of course, the skinny Elvis. American stamps give us a window into our past and our present. Well, stamps have such a strong message, you know, in addition to that, thinking of, you know, putting our national leaders, our symbols of democracy, on our stamps. When does the U.S. start to use stamps as kind of tools for propaganda, for messaging?
Well, the real king of that was FDR, who was a stamp collector and had been from his youth. And he understood very, very clearly the power of the stamp as a bearer of a message. And the stamps up until 1933 had been a bit cluttered. And he said, right, I want the stamps bright colours, uncluttered, with a nice, clear, positive, upbeat message.
So they have stamps that, for example, were used to promote the New Deal, marking peace conferences. We have the first photograph of the Earth in the 1960s. But when do we actually start to see popular culture reflected in stamps? You mentioned Harry Potter, but that's fairly recent.
Well, it really comes in with a great blast at the beginning of the Clinton era. Suddenly the baby boomers are in charge, and it's shown very quickly on the stamps. I think, actually, to be precise, the decision had been made even before Clinton came to the White House, but it coincides with extraordinary accuracy and sort of appropriateness. The famous popular culture stamp of that era is the Elvis stamp.
Oh, right, when you got to vote for the fat or the skinny Elvis.
You got to vote for the fat or the skinny, absolutely, that's right.
So, I'm sorry, refresh our memory on that. What was going on?
1993, they had a competition to see which of two designs of Elvis Presley people wanted on a stamp. And you could go into a post office and vote on a piece of paper. And there was a young Elvis and an old Elvis, and the young Elvis won, I think, quite convincingly. And the stamp came out, and it is a classic, and it is still the most collected U.S. stamp.
I've been hearing an awful lot about the slow death of the U.S. Postal Service for quite some time now. where do you see the future of stamps?
Well, I just think they're going to tootle along. I mean, I don't... The problem is that nowadays a lot of the parcel post, for example, which is the booming sector, doesn't seem to use stamps. I think there's also a problem with a kind of philatelic inflation, that there's, you know, the more issues come out purely aimed at collectors, the more, in a sense, it becomes an artifice. The joy of stamp collecting is partially that this thing was stuck on a letter. And so, going back to the Civil War, there might have been a letter, a love letter, or a letter of someone who's dying or something. I mean, this was serious stuff. But just a sort of series of little bits of paper with Mickey Mouse on or something doesn't have the same depth of story to it. And I think the depth of story attached to the used stamps is part of their fascination.
Well, Chris West, wonderful speaking with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Virginia. It's been great.
Chris West, author of A History of America in 36 Postage Stamps, also A History of Britain in 36 Stamps. You'll find photos of some of the remarkable stamps that we talked about today, as well as others, on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Up next on Word of Mouth, the latest in our Good Gig series. That's conversations with people who've landed their dream job. We're going to hear from a fire repeller who helps fight wildfires by jumping into them from a helicopter. That's after the break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is a special kind of person who doesn't run away, in fact, comes running when someone yells, "Fire!" Firefighters are a breed apart from most of us, and someone who'd get lowered from a helicopter into a fire tearing through the open air, well, that is another species altogether. And Jessica Crump is one of them. She's a helicopter repeller, or officially, a wildland firefighter for the United States Forestry Service, and she's based out of Grants Pass, Oregon. She's joining us now as part of our Good Gigs series. Jess, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much for having me here, Virginia.
Well, it is such a high-impact job, but also a really, really dangerous one. What got you started in this?
Honestly, it was the just the appeal, the overall job in general, just being out in the woods all summer long, getting to bond with your crew and yeah, pretty much being paid by the government to go out on a kind of a camping trip almost.
Well, a camping trip that involves rappelling from helicopters into fires.
Right.
How did you train for this?
The Forest Service has a pretty extensive program that they end up putting their recruits through. Initially, you go through a month-long program that's at the individual base that you work for. Mm-hmm. And then nationally, they bring all the crews together out in Salmon, Idaho every year, and they put you through rappel training, which mm-hmm. is anywhere from a week to a week and a half.
So what do you do? So let me just do a scenario here. You know, there's notice of a fire. You and your crew gather. What happens next?
So what ends up happening usually is the lookouts, which are strategically placed in the forest, will call in to dispatch that they have a smoke report. And essentially, an alarm goes off at the base, and within 10 minutes, our first load, which consists of four repellers, will be completely suited up and on the helicopter, and the idea is that the helicopter is lifting off within those 10 minutes. And then we fly out to the coordinates, hopefully locate that smoke, and then anywhere from 5-10 minutes, we hope to be on the ground. So we'll rappel out of the helicopter and hopefully land on the ground within 1/10 of a mile from the fire. Usually the closer the better, of course, mm-hmm. and helicopter will then come back and lower our gear down to us, and we'll go into suppression activities.
Oh, my goodness. So that's really fast. Tell me a little bit about that feeling, you know, of when you're getting lowered, you know, maybe not into a blaze, as you said, but as near as possible. What's going through your head then?
Well, honestly, so it's more, as opposed to actually being, like, tied to a rope and lowered down, we are rappelling. We are sliding down the ropes ourselves, so we are controlling our own speed and, you know, controlling when we do make contact with the ground. And honestly, you're so trained. The Forest Service just does such a good job of training you that you're only on the rope for tops, you know, 2 to 3 seconds. And usually you're on the ground before you even realize what happened.
Wow. Well, Jessica, I'm sure you're aware. I mean, the entire hotshot crew of 19 firefighters were caught in a deadly wildfire in Arizona. This is in June of last year, if I'm remembering it correctly, in Arizona. So so when you hear a story like that, what is it, a chill must run through you.
You know, it just, it resonates through the whole fire community. We're all family out there, you know. People are out there, you know, most of us for 6 months straight. And a lot of that time when fire season starts, it's just nonstop. You really don't get the opportunity to see your blood family or your friends outside of fire. So you really form tight bonds with the people you work with. Mm-hmm. So to hear a tragedy like that, it just hits everyone so hard. And you just, you know, you try to learn as much as you can from incidents like that in order to prevent them in the future. That's really all we can do to honor those who have fallen.
Are there many other women doing it, Jessica?
There's a handful of us out there that do enjoy the rappel side of things. I'd say you get about 10%.
Wow. Any deference shown to women? I mean, I know in some branches of the forestry service, there is, I don't know, some talk of like women don't see the action in the same way as men do.
Oh, no, I would say that's kind of the beauty of the Forest Service, actually, is that there is one standard across the board for both men and women. And, of course, I'm talking about a fitness standard as well as just an ability to perform technically, especially when it comes to rappelling.
So when we do hear of big fires sweeping across the West, do they call the crews? Do they bring people in from all over?
So when you do have the larger fires, we call them like the type 1, type 2 fires, those are your 100,000, 200,000 acre fires, they'll call in like hotshot crews, a lot of ground resources. So rappel specific fires are kind of your type 5, type 4 fires. So these are your fires that are only maybe an acre to 2 acres. So the idea of initial attack, which is what a rappel crew is used for, is to get into that fire in as short a period of time as possible to put it out before it grows into a type 1 or type 2 fire.
Mm-hmm. So you're sort of the first responders.
Yes, exactly, which is why time is so important.
I wonder what your scariest experience has been so far.
Oh, man, scariest experience. Running out of coffee on the fire. No. No. I'd have to say there's times where when you're on the rope, you have very little control sometimes as far as where the helicopter gets kind of pushed around by the wind. Mm-hmm. And there are times where you'll get, you know, tangled up in trees, snags, things in the area. And again, the idea is to get on the ground as fast as possible, because the whole time that you're on that rope, you're not only endangering yourself, but everyone else in the helicopter.
Yeah, you're just blowing around there, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Okay, Jess Crump, do you have the best gig?
Definitely. And you can ask any wildland firefighter out there, and they will tell you that they love their job, hands down.
Jessica Crump, she is a helicopter rappeller, or officially a wildland firefighter for the United States Forestry Service based out of Grants Pass, Oregon. Thank you so much. And may I say, you are a real hotshot.
Oh, no. Thank you very much, Virginia. I appreciate it.
And from a good gig to one that is astonishingly bad. When Word of Mouth returns, we're going to take a look into the unglamorous life of a paid audience member for daytime TV. That's after a quick break when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you've ever watched daytime television, you've seen them. nodding in agreement with Dr. Phil, gasping in shock during America's Court with Judge Ross, clapping along to the doctors. And there's a good chance you've seen them more than once, because many of the people filling the seats of daytime talk programs are paid audience members, getting paid for sitting around on a soundstage, which seems pretty sweet, right? Well, it is not such a cushy job. Reporter Aitana Vargas went undercover as a paid audience member and wrote about conditions for Narratively in an article called The Underpaid Grunts of TV Talk Show Land. Aitana, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much for having me here today.
Now, I assume that these were maybe tourists who wanted to see their favorite shows being taped. How widespread is the practice of paying people to sit in audiences?
Actually, it's very widespread. I would say all of the shows that I went to during my three-month investigation, all of them would pay their audience workers. Some of the shows would also accept some tourists who wouldn't be paid, but they need to rely on paid audience members to be able to tape the shows.
Any particularly well-known shows that you know of that pay for audiences?
Many of them. A very popular show actually called The Jeff Probst Show. I attended that show a number of times. Also, The Doctors, which is a very popular show as well. And even Take It All or Judge Judy and Judge Joe Brown. Right. I'm sure you're familiar with those names.
Yeah, and Jeff Probst from Survivor. Is that the guy that you're talking about?
That's exactly the guy that I'm talking about, yes.
Now, how much do people get paid?
It really depends on the show and the recruiting agency, but most of the time you can get either minimum wage. Sometimes you do not even get minimum wage. There's one show that I attended, which is broadcast in Telemundo, which is owned by NBC, and you would be getting paid $50 for more than 9 hours of work a day. So we are talking about less than minimum wage there.
9 hours? Why so long?
Because they would be taping three shows in one day. And if there is something that goes wrong, they have to keep retaping. So you have to stay there for 9 hours, sometimes even 10 hours.
You mentioned Telemundo, and I'd love to talk with you about that experience. But I'm wondering if shows in general are looking for a specific demographic when casting the audience.
Absolutely. I mean, they're looking for students. They're looking for people who are in need for cash. They're also looking for undocumented immigrants who really need that money and who don't have a work permit or a social security number to be able to get a decent job. So those are the people that you are going to see sit in the audience in television shows.
Well, for this article, you did play the part of a paid audience member for a couple of different shows. One was for Doce Corazones, which is a popular show on Telemundo. That is the Spanish language network. Now, tell us about that experience. What did you have to do?
Well, that show is very interesting. For me, it was one of the most, I would say, shocking experiences that I've had. There were 20 men and 20 women in the audience. And as part of the female audience members, I had to be screaming at the male contestants and talking about how sexy they were, even if I didn't think they were sexy. So it was, for me, it was a very shocking experience. I also felt pretty embarrassed to be there. I really didn't want to be there.
Okay, so that's once you're there, but give us the whole experience. I mean, when did you have to show up? Were you given instructions? Were you given any kind of training?
I wouldn't say that I was given any training. I had to show up around 2 p.m. So the show would go from 2 p.m. until approximately 11, 11:30 p.m. Well, the taping of the three shows. And during the tapings, we had a couple of breaks. One of them was 30 minutes long. The other one was about 45 minutes long. And they would actually provide, the production crew would give you some food and some drinks. So that was actually nice on their part. But when you were inside the studio and they were taping, you couldn't really go to the bathroom if you had to, unless they gave you the green light. Also, once you were inside the studio, it would get extremely hot because they would actually have the AC off. They didn't want the noise bothering the taping, so it would be off. So you can imagine, it was extremely hot there. So everybody was just you know, going for the bottle of water, trying to hydrate themselves. And it was very uncomfortable.
Well, how did the show audience get you, you know, busting to use the bathroom, hot, sweaty, exhausted at the end of the day to seem enthusiastic?
Well, here's how they do it. If you don't do it, you don't come back to the show. So, and they would let you know about it. I mean, the audience coordinator, who was sitting a few meters away from the audience member, she would come up to us a number of times during the tapings, and she would say, "You're not smiling enough. If you don't smile enough, you know, I'm not calling you back."
You're kind of playing an actor, I guess, on some level.
You're absolutely playing an actor. And if you're not playing an actor, like I said, you're not coming back.
How does one actually become a paid audience member? Do you have to, you know, apply, just show up?
Okay, so yeah, there are different ways in which you can go about doing this. You can actually go on Craigslist, and you have to look for paid audience work. That's one of the ways to do it. You can also go on Google, and you can just Google that. Paid audience work. And what you will find is a number of agencies, recruiting agencies, that will be offering those services. So they are the ones that you have to sign up with, and they will take you to different shows. So you have to perhaps send an email to this recruiting agency. Sometimes there are also individuals that are doing this. You send an email, you send a photo of you looking good, because you have to look good. And if they like you, they will send you an email back, or they will call you back and tell you that you can go to one of the shows.
Now, Aitana Vargas, you spoke to several people who were paid audience members. Any common threads, any common motivations for why they did this work?
Yes. The common motivation is they simply needed the money. Some of them, a very few of them, also wanted to become maybe an actor or an actress. They were not getting those gigs, so they turned to audience work as a means of survival.
Is this a kind of one-off thing, or do people tend to do it for a living?
It is difficult to do it for a living, but they do it for a living. Some people can actually make up to $800 a month. So for somebody who doesn't have a job, that's a lot of money.
Now, you talk about the experience in paid audience members not being particularly good, them not even making minimum wage, some undocumented workers. I wondered if you contacted any of the networks in your investigation and asked them about this.
I contacted a number of them. I even contacted, obviously, NBC, Telemundo, the audience coordinator at 12 Corazones, and I didn't really get a reply. I also got in touch with the recruiting agencies and asked them and gave them the opportunity to offer commentary on this. And except one person, nobody else wanted to provide any comments. The one person that I talked to, who is an individual, she has her own company and she recruits audience members for a living. She actually denied that she was recruiting members for some of the shows.
How important are these paid audience members to these television productions? I mean, if they refuse to work for low wages, for example, what would happen?
They're extremely important. I mean, I would say they're a key part of any of the shows. Sometimes the shows require 200, 300 people in a studio. There's no way you're going to recruit enough audience workers without paying them to be in a show and in a taping for hours and hours and hours. So I would say that if the workers said, "We're not going to do this unless we get all the protections of the law," the shows would have to comply.
Aitana, I'm wondering if now when you're watching these daytime television shows, are you spending a lot more time looking at the audience than what's going on stage?
Actually, I am. I look at their faces and I think, you know, I can relate to all of them.
Aitana Vargas, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much.
Aitana Vargas is a reporter. She's based in California. And there's a link to read her article that she wrote for Narratively. It's called "The Underpaid Grunts of TV Talk Show Land." That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And Word of Mouth returns in just a moment with the story of a set of twins who were adopted by different parents on different continents as babies, who discovered each other 25 years later, randomly, on social media. We'll reunite with that story after a short break.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It began, as many things do today, online. First, a screenshot of Korean-American actress Samantha Futterman from a short film posted on YouTube.
Holy shit, is that a mullet? You look like Billy Ray Cyrus, but Asian, okay? So please, just leave.
I'm gonna leave now.
You should go.
You're a terrible
person. Bye.
A design student in London noticed that the actress in the video looked just like his friend, Anaïs Bordier, a young French woman who'd been adopted from South Korea. Anaïs dug around and found more videos and pictures of Samantha online. She then discovered that they shared the same birthday and were adopted from the same Korean town. Was it possible that they could be twins? Well, it is an amazing story, but the two girls, adopted and raised on two continents, found each other on social media 25 years later. Anaïs Bordier and Samantha Futterman are working now on a documentary film of their experience and have together written Separated at Birth, a true love story of twin sisters reunited. Anaïs Bordier and Samantha Futterman, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Oh, look, they even talk at the same time. That's so sweet. Anaïs, I'm wondering what it was like for you when your friend, Kelsang, I think, sent you a screenshot of this woman who looked just like you. What was your thought?
First, I was really angry because I thought somebody had just posted a video of myself on YouTube without asking permission for it. And then, after 5 seconds clicking on the link, I discovered it was a video of a girl who looked exactly like me.
Mm-hmm. She was not credited in that little short film. You, however, raised in Paris and Brussels. Now, what did you know about the circumstances of your birth and your adoption from South Korea at that time?
So what I knew was that I was a single child and then that my birth mother couldn't keep me. Mm-hmm. I didn't know anything about my birth father. You know, we didn't have much more information except she was young, probably.
Mm-hmm. Even your adoptive mother didn't think it could have been possible that you had a twin because she said to the adoption agency she would take twins if they had them, right?
Yes, indeed. They would have been happy to adopt siblings, you know, but they were not presented the opportunity actually on the paper.
So, Sam, you got a Facebook message from Anaïs in February of 2013. You were a little doubtful. Why?
Well, I guess when you get a friend request from yourself on Facebook, it's a bit jarring experience. And I thought she was my friend Kev Jumba is a popular YouTuber. I thought she was just a fan, like a crazy fangirl of his.
Mm-hmm.
But then after, again, like my sister was saying, clicking into the pictures, I realized she was a actual person. And then after reading the message and finding out that we were born on the same day in the same place, I began to realize that it could be true.
Now, what convinced you then to have that first conversation on Skype? How did you feel leading into that?
Leading into the Skype? It's mm-hmm. nerve-wracking. I mean, mm-hmm. you don't know what's going to pop up on the other side of the screen, you know? It could be some crazy person across the world. But, I mean, it's just the next logical step after meeting each other through message. The next step is Skype, right? And then to go on to meet in person.
What were you looking for? I mean, I'm sure the physical, you write about, you know, sort of like she had the same freckles, you know, the same expressions. But were you kind of testing each other to figure out how you were similar in the world?
Yes, we have the same size, the same, I guess, voice intonation, but very different accents. We have the same, some similar habits. We had the same haircuts when we were children, which is really strange because we were not anywhere close in the world, and our parents were still choosing our haircuts. Yes, we discovered so many similarities. We did some cognitive tests with Dr. Nancy Siegel, and except for, how do you call it?
Like emotional testing.
Yeah, emotional testing. The other tests look so similar. The results are so close. You know, it feels nature is so strong as well.
Yeah, this is Dr. Siegel. She's a lead researcher on a study that's gone on for 20 years from University of Minnesota, study of twins. reared apart. Well, what did this reveal to either of you about your thinking on nature versus nurture?
It definitely changed my perspective. I thought mostly everything was nurture, but finding out that DNA definitely plays a big role in our genetic and social makeup.
Mm-hmm. What do you remember, Sam, as being some of the similarities between the two of you?
Our math scores were surprisingly low for us two Asian girls. Mm-hmm. but we're very visual people, so we could recognize patterns quite quickly. But then the differences, too, were really interesting with the nurture. It's just that I think growing up with brothers and growing up as an only child and just in the vast different environments, you know, and how we were treated as adoptees growing up.
I'm also reading here in the book, you both hated cook vegetables, both yes. brush your teeth many, many times a day. Both require 10 hours of sleep a night plus daily naps.
Yeah, we don't get the sleep much anymore. So many little naps in.
Not on a book tour, certainly. I mean, you also had kind of different emotional responses to your circumstances of birth. I mean, a lot gets revealed in this book about how the Korean agency, that Korean agency in particular, was run. And since you've discovered that there are several other twins and sets of triplets that have been separated. Now, do you know why they were separated?
I think a lot had to do with the economical situation in Korea at the time and that many families couldn't afford to take care of two young children, especially after having multiple children already. So I feel that was mostly the case, and one child was kept with the birth family. But for us, it was kind of a very, very unique circumstance.
Mm-hmm. Both of you, as similar as you are, both of you had kind of different responses to the response from your birth mother. Now that you go to the agency in South Korea trying to find your mother, you do find a foster mother, but the woman who was ID'd as your mother denied giving birth to you two. You both seem to have different feelings about that. Can you articulate those for us?
Yes. I mean, I understand her choice of not responding now. Maybe it's not her, but it probably is. I'm very respectful towards her choice. I hope that someday she will want to talk to us. But we don't know the circumstances. So sometimes you don't want to. I mean, we're so happy already that we found each other, and I'm feeling that I don't want to know more because it sounds like she had probably a difficult time or she was in a difficult situation. So I don't want to go too far in the research if she's not ready for it yet.
Sam, how about you? You're a little more eager in your pursuit?
I was in the, like, you know, before the situation when I was going back to Korea for the first time, I put out a call to try to find her. It was something that the opportunity again presented itself. So I thought, why not do it now? But now that she's denied it, you understand that, you know, it's her life too. It's not just us. It's not just about us. It's about the entire family, and every person has a side of the story. So hopefully one day we'll find her. But again, we don't want to press her because she has feelings too. It's not just us. So one day, if we have the chance, that would be amazing. And if it never happens, then we have each other.
Well, there'll be a whole other story in another book, I can imagine. Well, you've been on this world now for 18 months, working on a documentary film, you know, written this book, you know, you're doing press right now. So where do you go from there? I mean, there's this initial excitement. Is there a wish to kind of reconstruct your lives together? How do you carry on with a twin sister you never had?
Well, our bond is too strong. I don't think we can spend too much time apart. So there's no fear of losing each other now, that's for sure.
Yeah, I feel exactly the same. Like, we have social medias. We can WhatsApp every day. We can Skype whenever we want. I can wake up my sister if I want in the middle of her night on the West Coast. And, I mean, we've been traveling a lot. We speak the same language, which is amazing, so we can communicate. And I guess we're not scared to just travel above ocean.
Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us. I appreciate it. Merci bien, Anaïs.
Merci beaucoup.
And Samantha Futterman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Anaïs Bordier and Samantha Futterman. Their new book is called Separated at Birth, a true love story of twin sisters reunited. They're also working on a documentary film called Twinsters, funded by the pair through Kickstarter. You can find more information at wordofmouthradio.org. And now a tale of love, marriage, and two sets of twins from StoryCorps. It was the summer of 1946. Honey Feller and her identical twin sister Bunny were waitresses at a hotel. Another set of identical twins, Elliot and Danny Riken, worked as musicians in a band there. Honey and Elliot picked the story up from there.
When we met, you and your sister couldn't tell us apart, and we couldn't tell you two apart.
But by the end of the summer, there was no chance of separating us. And we had a double wedding. You and I were married the same day as Bunny and Danny were married. And it was two brides, two grooms, one set of parents for each. The gowns were identical gowns. The flowers were identical.
We both went on our honeymoon to Miami Beach by different trains.
Yeah, so people wouldn't
be so obvious that people would be staring at us. You know,
yeah, the twins that married the twins.
What did you think about marrying me many years ago?
You bowled me over with your way of kissing and the way you hold me when we dance. You're not a fantastic dancer, but you hold me fantastically, and I feel it. It's genuine. You're just not phony. I don't think you have a phony bone in your body. And I never thought anybody lasts this many years.
Like just yesterday, it was our 50th anniversary.
Yeah, now it's 11 years after that.
Yeah.
I never feel, what will he do if I die first? You know how to open tuna fish. You know how to smear it with mayonnaise. You will not fall apart. You'll feel sad when I'm gone, but you'll manage, and that makes me feel very good. Thank you for being you, Elliot. You made my life complete.
And I say the same. You made my life complete. And hope we go on for another 50 years.
I'll take five good ones. Five good ones. And I'll say thank you, God.
Honey and Elliot Riken at StoryCorps in New York City. The Rikens live in Brooklyn in the same house they bought with their twins more than 50 years ago. Honey's sister Bunny still lives upstairs. Their interview will be archived at the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. Thank you so much for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there's much more at wordofmouthradio.org. Earlier in the show, we spoke with a fire repeller, Jess Crump, for our latest installment of Good Gig, conversations with people who've landed their dream job, and we would love to hear from you. Do you have a good gig? We're looking for guests for our series, so if you love your job, we'd love to know about it, especially if it's a gig that few people think of as work. You can go to our Facebook page and tell us about what you do, or send a brief email to wordofmouth@nhpr.org and put good gig in the subject line. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow, too, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.